Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. So, the Courier-Journal hires a former New York Times foreign correspondent and assigns him to cover eastern Kentucky. Given the region's exquisite sensitivity to the judgment of outsiders, how did that work out? We're about to find out. Pulitzer Prize finalist and investigative reporter Alan Maiman spent 5 years living and working in Hazard. His reporting forms the basis of the book Twilight in Hazard, An Appalachian Reckoning, publishing in June. Alan Maiman joins us from Princeton, New Jersey. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Alan.
Thanks, Tom.
So tell us what it was like for you when you first rolled into Hazard and began adjusting to life in your new home.
Well, Tom, yeah, those first few weeks in Hazard around Christmas 2000 were very cold, a little bit lonely. Tried the best I could to familiarize myself with my new environment, knowing that I was going to be responsible for covering a large swath of area in eastern Kentucky. And having come from Germany and having reported from Germany, especially in parts of the former East Germany, some of the stories I did there had to do with the systemic doping of former swimmers, female swimmers in East Germany. And that was a real eye-opening experience for me in terms of meeting these women, meeting their families, talking to them, hearing their stories, really tragic stories about being taken away from their homes as preteens, being pumped full of performance-enhancing drugs, and really experiencing the consequences of that later in life. These were not the deep-voiced, muscle-bound caricatures that we've sort of come to think of when we think of the East German swimmer. It's been parodied so many times in television, movies. Kind of took that knowledge with me to Eastern Kentucky, because Eastern Kentucky has been subject to the same type of stereotype and caricature over the years, and I really set out to bring a more three-dimensional view of life in Eastern Kentucky. What I stepped into was a series of really era-defining events, socially, economically, politically, that kept me extremely busy. My learning curve sped up into overdrive, just coming to cover the emergence of the opioid crisis, the Martin County slurry spill, drug-motivated political murders, and just a growing coarseness in both local and national politics.
Well, you say in the book that you got to know Eastern Kentucky at a pivotal time, that what you saw confirmed some biases, challenged others. Can you elaborate on that? What was confirmed? What was challenged?
Well, every year or so, I would do a fairly lengthy story that I would refer to as a straight poverty story. And those would always come about because of the latest census data or local report or national report. So clearly what I found looking at the numbers and the cold hard statistics was that Eastern Kentucky was a region in distress. That since Lyndon Johnson came to Martin County to launch the war on poverty in the 60s, that from a purely numbers-based economic standpoint, not a lot had changed. Now, in terms of something that was challenged, I think it's very important for people to know, and I think people in the region know this, but I'm not sure how much outside the region this is known, is that there are extraordinary pockets of wealth in eastern Kentucky as well. So it's really truly a haves and have-nots region.
So a lot went on in your life during those 5 years. As I mentioned in the introduction, you became literally wedded to the region. And while there, you met your wife-to-be, a coal miner's daughter. Did she offer guidance in your reporting, pointing out things that you might not have known to pursue on your own?
Absolutely, yeah. She's from Harlan County. Pretty early on in our relationship, her father Robert passed away from black lung. This was in 2003, and he was 53 years old. So as I was writing about coal mining and black lung, I saw up close and personal way the human and tragic toll of that disease. In terms of what she told me and helped me with, she always reminds me to remember the strong sense of community in Eastern Kentucky, and I absolutely have taken that to heart because that is truly something that makes the region special, whether it be an anonymous person paying for all of the layaway items at the Hazard Walmart last Christmas, and on, that there is an admirable sense of community in Eastern Kentucky.
You mentioned that the outcome of the 2008 Kentucky Democratic presidential primaries was one of the things that actually motivated you to write the book. Why was that?
Well, that data is, you know, every time I look at it, it's staggering to me that to take listeners back to that 2008 Democratic primary between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and the primary in Kentucky took place very shortly before Barack Obama secured the nomination, so he was pretty well on his way to becoming the Democratic nominee. However, when the Kentucky Democratic primary rolled around in many eastern Kentucky counties, Hillary Clinton beat Barack Obama by 80 points in some counties. So, in other words, Hillary Clinton achieved over 90% of the vote in some places, which is incredible, especially considering that just 8 years later, she lost in similar numbers against Donald Trump. So that really got me to thinking about the political dynamics in Eastern Kentucky, which really have become emblematic of the politics in many parts of rural America.
And what particular dynamics have you identified?
Well, as we know, the 5th Congressional District in Kentucky is, if not the reddest district in the country, it's one of the reddest. What we've seen in Eastern Kentucky is a migration from blue to red. The 2004 presidential election between John Kerry and George W. Bush was the last time we saw any pockets of blue in Eastern Kentucky. And that trend has really played out in other parts of the country and certainly explains how Donald Trump won the 2016 election with just incredible support and turnout in Eastern Kentucky and other parts of rural America.
A 2014 survey found that the congressional district covering Eastern Kentucky, the 5th District, ranked last among all 434 districts in people's perception of general health and outlook on life. Did your reporting confirm those kinds of findings?
Well, yeah, again, this is I believe I say in the book, this is not an image projected from the outside. This was a survey of people in the region itself. Yes, to a large extent. When I would make the rounds, and I spent a lot of time in my car driving throughout the region, saw a lot of people who were hurting, both physically and mentally, and who were on Social Security disability, whose outlook on life really was pretty bleak.
In the preface of your book, you say that when you think about the things that you saw and documented in Appalachian Kentucky, you realize that this small swath of America with a population of about 700,000 offers tremendous insight into who we are and what we value as a nation. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, this is an area that to a large extent has been left behind and that certainly has a lot of pent-up frustration. I think that it helps explain the rise of Donald Trump, somebody who many people who I have spoken to in Eastern Kentucky say is someone who finally has given them a voice. And that's just so interesting to hear. Being a Northeasterner and having, you know, followed Donald Trump's career for many years, it's just a very surprising development to see this man be someone who can really capture the imaginations of so many people in Eastern Kentucky and elsewhere. So, yes, what I saw in Eastern Kentucky every day, what I covered there every day, frustration, the sort of being painted with the brush of otherness, which I think is a really important thing here, that that is something that we saw play out across the country in electoral politics, but also on social issues as well. The social conservatism of Eastern Kentucky, certainly a reflection of the extreme divisiveness that we're seeing all over the country when it comes to gun owners and abortion rights and things like that.
We have a question from Gil Hunter. He's the director of retention and graduation at EKU. He asks, you lost your position in Hazard as hard times came to print journalism. And he wants to know, should readers see the bleak present and future of print media as maybe a parallel with the decline of the coal industry in Eastern Kentucky?
Well, I think that it's been very sad to see the demise of so much local journalism across the country. I was the last Hazard bureau chief of the Louisville Courier-Journal. The Courier-Journal obviously has carried on. In terms of the decline of the coal industry, I'll just say this. I think that the print media has a very large role to play in terms of covering the coal industry. The fundamental question in the coal mining regions of Eastern Kentucky and throughout West Virginia, many parts of Central Appalachia, is how do you go about coming up with a strategy, economic strategy, for the future? A lot of my stories dealt with that, and this was 20 years ago. Those same conversations are happening now with a much greater urgency because the coal industry has continued to sort of make it clear that next boom is not coming. So what's next?
Well, with fewer professional reporters on the ground today in important locations around southeastern Kentucky, how can any progress, or any lack of progress for that matter, in solving the region's most pressing problems be tracked, be followed?
It's difficult. There's still great print papers that have made wonderful transitions into creating an online presence. The Washington Post, the New York Times, ProPublica do a wonderful job of merging old and new media forms. And occasionally they send reporters to places like Eastern Kentucky. But that type of parachute journalism isn't a replacement for the day-in, day-out immersion that you would have if the Courier-Journal, for example, still had its Hazard Bureau. This keeps public officials on their toes and just helps tell the stories of the region in a much more thorough and dynamic way.
Right. Well, Gil Hunter also notes that the final paragraph of the book states that we have to combat the notion that people and places are irredeemable by telling their stories. Tell us about the influential people that you met, including the ones with the potential to redeem the place.
Well, I think it's an all-hands-on-deck effort. One thing that really gives me optimism that Eastern Kentucky can find a way to transition away from the coal-based economy is that I've talked to economic development leaders in the region who I think have real vision for the future. I think 20 years ago, 15 years ago when I was there, it felt a little bit like lip service was being paid to how do we move past coal. I think now, today, the urgency of the situation is being recognized and some really smart people are thinking about how to do this. And it's not going to be easy. The reason the book is called Twilight in Hazard is that twilight is a combination of dark and light, but what comes after that? Dark. And there will be a period of darkness while things are figured out, but then the morning comes. And so it's my hope that when the morning comes, there will be a future for Eastern Kentucky where, where some of the generational, you know, poverty issues that have plagued it for so long are minimized.
Before I let you go, Alan, I have one bone to pick, and you know what it is. And
yes.
I think that you will appreciate this question. But you mentioned a map in the office of then Hazard Mayor Bill Gorman with pins stuck in it. And one's over Morehead State University, another over Berea College. But no pin for Eastern Kentucky University. And there's the implication that EKU's name is a misnomer. while, in fact, 49% of the EKU student body actually comes from eastern and southeastern Kentucky. That's our service area. So we're all wondering, can you fix that if there's a second printing of the book?
I've already made a note to do so, along with a couple of other things that you've opened my eyes to. Now, I'd be interested to know into the year 2000 what that percentage was, but it's clear to me that, yeah, that though not physically located in the mountains of Eastern Kentucky, that Eastern Kentucky University is doing a very admirable job of serving that community, not only through the institution itself, but through WEKU, which was a staple of my days when I was there. I listened to WEKU all the time as I was traversing Eastern Kentucky looking for stories.
That's great to know. And point made, this was 20 years ago when this observation was made. And I didn't check on what proportion of the student body was out of that region at that time. So it could be different. We'll find out. Be interesting to know.
I would be very interested to know. But yes, whenever you do a book, there are things that you make notes of in the hopes that a paperback edition will come out and that you can update it. Absolutely.
We've been talking with investigative reporter Alan Maiman, author of Twilight in Hazard and Appalachian Reckoning, publishing June 8th under the Melville House imprint. Thank you so much, Alan.
It was great being with you, Tom. Thank you.
We're interested in your thoughts on this topic. You can email us at es@eku.edu or leave a voicemail at 859-622-9358. 859-622-9358. Indicate whether your comments can be shared with our listeners in an upcoming edition of Eastern Standard. Alan Maiman talks about the loss of local newspapers in many Kentucky communities. It comes up in a conversation between Jim Trimble, host of our series on the virtues of a democratic society, and veteran Kentucky journalist and educator Al Cross.
Al Cross, one of the freedoms granted in our Constitution in this country, freedom of the press, established so independent journalism, news gathering, news presenting, couldn't be controlled by either the government or a certain party or a certain person. Why is that important in this country?
Well, because if you're going to have a democracy, people need to be able to make well-informed decisions. James Madison wrote a letter to the lieutenant governor of Kentucky back in 1822 saying that democracy without popular information is a prelude to a farce or a travesty or both. And back in those days, there were no really independent newspapers. Each party had a newspaper. Each faction sometimes had a newspaper. But not long after that, we developed newspapers that were commercial enterprises on their own and could survive commercially. The country grew to the point where newspaper advertising was a good thing for business, and newspapers developed a circulation. One thing about this country is we have a high literacy rate. And that has made for lots of local newspapers in this country. In Canada, we probably have more local newspapers per capita than any other two countries in the world.
Now, the local newspaper, like you said, it's one of the stalwarts of any community or town or city.
Yes, and when you lose a newspaper, as about 2,000 communities have in the last 20 years or so, a community loses part of its identity. It's cohesiveness. I like to say that a newspaper is the I-beam of the civic infrastructure. It runs right through the middle of the building and everybody else connects to it.
How has things like radio, TV, internet affected, say, the news gathering and news presenting, the journalistic integrity of the newspaper?
Well, you're really talking about a couple of different things there. Radio and television really didn't have much effect on newspapers. Newspapers were in a consolidating mode anyway. Radio did cost a local newspaper, radio and TV cost local newspapers their national advertising, but that was something they were able to overcome as local economies continued to grow and newspapers developed expertise. What's really hurt newspapers in the last 20 years is the digital world. There is no longer any business model for news. Just a commodity, and the commodities tend to have the lowest possible price. And people can access news for free most any place, most any time. It's the quality of the news or where it's coming from and what it's about that have changed. There aren't very many digital publishers who are specializing in covering local communities because there's no real money in it. I publish a digital newspaper for Midway, Kentucky with my students, but it would not be a commercial enterprise if we wanted to make it one. So in the last 5 or 6 years, newspapers have taken a double hit as the local advertisers have discovered digital and how it can work for them. And here in the pandemic, local advertising has really been hit in the head, and it's actually led to the closure of some weekly newspapers in Kentucky and even one daily newspaper in Glasgow. And that's not something I would have expected to see until much later on in this decade.
Growing up in Louisville, I always had the morning Courier-Journal in the house and the afternoon Louisville Times. Over time, the afternoon newspaper dropped away. The Bingham family sold the Courier-Journal to Gannett, which is a national conglomerate. And there was a loss of a lot of things. I know that the Courier-Journal, for instance, had, you know, bureaus in different parts of the state. The change in that has got to be enormous.
Well, the Courier-Journal was the one thing that a lot of people in Kentucky had in common. They had a common source of information about the workings of state government and sometimes the governments of even their localities with the bureaus that existed in Paducah, Hazard, Bowling Green, Somerset, Elizabethtown, Shelbyville, Covington, Madisonville have all had bureaus at one time or the other. The last of those bureaus in Paducah and Hazard closed in 2005. The Frankfort Bureau has remained open, but it no longer has a physical location, and there's only one person assigned to Frankfort. So that is a real change. It's easier to cover things than it used to be with digital media. You don't necessarily have to be in a place. You can use video to access events. But there's really no substitute for looking people in the eye and having a conversation with them and developing those sources. There's an old saying in journalism, a reporter is only as good as his or her sources. And I'm afraid we're missing a lot of stories these days.
Now that everyone has a camera and a typewriter and a tape recorder or whatever in their pocket, everyone thinks they can maybe be a journalist. How has that affected the free press in this country?
I don't think it's really hurt it. I like to say that every American has the First Amendment right to commit journalism. And I say commit because that implies a sense of responsibility and rectitude. If you're going to call it journalism or make people think that it is journalism, a professional craft, then there are certain obligations that you have. You have a discipline of verification. You make sure something's correct, or you quote somebody, or you attribute material to them. Social media have no discipline and no verification, and they're mainly about opinion. Journalism is mainly about fact. Unfortunately, Americans fail to distinguish between those two, and I think a lot of journalistic outlets have done a bad job of making that distinction.
The small town newspaper, and I'm going to use the Winchester Sun as an example. That's where I live. I subscribe to it and have in the 2 years that I've lived there. And it's gone from a daily newspaper to now published twice a week.
Well, it's printed twice a week. They're updating every day. But that's a good point to make. You know, it was not a surprise when the pandemic hit and newspapers cut back their print circulation schedules. They just simply did not have the advertising to support that. Print advertising is still the straw that draws the drink for most newspapers. They just don't have a large enough geographic base to benefit from digital greatly and from a big audience that's willing to pay, like the audience of the New York Times, the Washington Post, USA Today, and the Wall Street Journal. Those are the four big national newspapers. You have some large regional papers like the Seattle Times, Dallas Morning News, the LA Times, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that have a significant population that they can use for a digital revenue. But even they have shrunk their circulation and coverage areas to not much beyond the metropolitan area, which is what has happened to most papers like the Courier-Journal and the Lexington Herald-Leader. Luckily, the Herald-Leader has obtained some philanthropic funding to cover the Eastern Kentucky coal field and the rest of Appalachian Kentucky. Without that, it would be really a great paucity of coverage in Eastern Kentucky.
How important is the press in a democracy like America?
Well, it's absolutely essential for the country to work in the way the founders intended. They passed the First Amendment, put it in the Constitution, because they didn't want any control other than ownership of a free press. Back in those days, the free presses were generally partisan, but as the craft developed and there was a good business model for objective journalism or journalism that tried to be objective, then we developed codes of ethics and practice that are generally followed by most journalism outlets. There's a misunderstanding about objectivity. Nobody can be really objective. You're always going to be subjective in what you choose to cover and how you report it, even though you try to be as logical and fair as you can be. What you have to do, though, is follow the objective method. You have to test all the information that you receive and then present your story, your report, based on the validity of that information that you get.
And when we have a presidential administration who says the press is the enemy of the people, how does that affect the journalistic integrity?
Well, it makes you choose sides. You know, you have to say, sorry, Mr. President, you're wrong. But I think the editor of the Washington Post, Marty Baron, puts it best. We're not at war. We're at work. By that, he means we do our work. We don't get into battles directly with the president. We just gather the facts and present them. And the Washington Post fact checker, run by Glenn Kessler, whose mother used to live in Lexington, has pointed out that the president has made more than 20,000 false or misleading statements. I think that people need to remember something that Donald Trump told Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes at the beginning of his administration. She asked him why he made such attacks on the press, and he said, so the people won't believe what you say about me. That's all you really need to remember.
Al Cross, thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Jim. Good talking with you.
You too. Al Cross is director of the Institute for Rural Journalism and Community Issues at the University of Kentucky.
Much more ahead. Stay with us. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Brian Burkhart with the Under Main Arts Minute, bringing you local and regional arts news and events. KMAC Museum's current exhibition, Reflects, Reframe, Remake, Remodel, 40 Years of Recrafting KMAC, is a survey of 40 artists featured in shows over the course of the Louisville Museum's 40 years of existence. The exhibition includes works by legendary Kentucky artists like Henry Faulkner and Ralph Eugene Meteor, as well as more recent exhibited artists like Vian Sora and Vinhei Kia. In doing so, the evolution of a museum dedicated to exploring how art and craft converge is showcased. More information, go to kmac.org. You can find in-depth writing about Kentucky arts online at undermain.art. This has been the Undermain Arts Minute for WEKU's Eastern Standard. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Virtual reality technology has been around for decades, but only recently has it been combined with 360-degree video as a tool to attract manufacturers to rural communities. One East Kentucky, an organization based in Paintsville that focuses on economic development and job creation in 9 Eastern Kentucky counties, recently rolled out this technology to expand efforts to market industrial parks and buildings that are for sale. Chuck Sexton is president and CEO of One East Kentucky, and Chuck joins us from Paintsville. Chuck Sexton, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate you allowing me to be here today.
And tell us, how are you using 360-degree video and virtual reality technologies to sell manufacturers on locating in Eastern Kentucky?
Well, the technology has been around for a little while and marketed to the economic development industry, if you want to call it that, for the last 4 or 5 years. When the pandemic hit, though, we saw an opportunity to implement that technology so that regardless of travel restrictions going forward, our organization could continue to market these 9 Eastern Kentucky counties that we represent to the world.
And is that working? Are you getting a response?
It is. Obviously, it's fairly new. We just got all of our videos online. We've been tracking hits on our website and on social media. But one of the other things that we're going to utilize this for is with the 3D goggles, the Quest VR goggles. We'll utilize those with recruitment missions that we have upcoming.
So why are rural economic development professionals like you adopting these particular technologies? I know that you mentioned that the pandemic has really kind of accelerated that, but wondered if you could expand on it just a bit.
Well, obviously, Eastern Kentucky and certain media representations can have a negative connotation. And so we're doing everything we can to put a positive light on what Eastern Kentucky has to offer private sector businesses to increase job creation within the region and increase capital investment and really create a new economic base. And any rural community across the country who's trying to do that, where rural areas are losing population, need to be on the forefront of utilizing technologies that can capture the attention of the private sector. We're implementing that, yes, because of COVID, but also because we want to stand out. We want to show decision makers, C-level decision makers, that we're innovative and creative, and we're on the forefront of utilizing new technologies.
I've taken a look at VR tours of several sites, an industrial building in Hazard, a site in Martin County, another in Louisa, and I'm seeing vacant industrial spaces and specs, but I'm no expert, so I don't really know what I'm looking at as a location specialist would. How do site location specialists use this kind of technology?
Well, the decision-making process for companies, for the private sector, has shortened dramatically over the last 10 years. And if you look back 10 years ago in the economic development sector and industry, a company may take a year to make a decision. That time frame has shortened as quickly as 3 months. And so a lot of times, communities are eliminated without ever having the opportunity to present themselves. You know, in 10 years ago, everyone would at least have some opportunity to paint a picture for a site location consultant as to what they have to offer their client. These days, site selectors are utilizing the internet to really cull down the list and get rid of as many communities as possible before they really dig deep into them. So the more tools we put digitally online and accessible to these decision makers, the more opportunities we have as a region.
How immersive or expansive is this technology? Does it take the viewer beyond that industrial site or that building and out into nearby communities?
Well, what we've done on the front end of this is we've made sure that all of our industrial real estate, first and foremost, is represented in a virtual manner. And we did an overall community and regional tour of Eastern Kentucky, hitting the highlights of each of our primary cities from Pikeville, Paintsville, Prestonsburg, Hazard, and hitting the quality of life aspects of the region, as well as some of the nightlife that people can enjoy here, outdoor activities. And so that piece of it doesn't come into play quite as often when it comes to making a decision for a company. Usually that comes into play more if the company is interested in moving executive personnel into a region. But for the most part, when a company is deciding to put an additional facility somewhere, they're not moving people in, they're hiring people from that region to run that facility and to work in it.
Well, Chuck, you're in economic development, and you have quite a challenge on your hands there. And I'm just wondering, what was your reaction when it became clear that you were going to have this particular kind of tool to work with?
Well, obviously, I was excited to get it online. It doesn't happen. Nothing happens as quickly as anybody wants it to these days.
Sure.
You know, we wanted it up and running 6 months ago, but that's just not how the world works. And so we've been excited to utilize the tool and put it into practice. And, you know, having something like this available to us, you know, I think back to a few years ago, we were at a trade show in Orlando. We had a nice big booth there promoting Eastern Kentucky to the aerospace industry. And I wish that I'd had this tool then because, you know, as Kentuckians do, to draw in the crowds, we had a bourbon tasting at our booth. And you wouldn't believe the amount of executives from Boeing and GE Aviation and all these massive companies who were coming to our booth and looking at our information. And I guarantee if we'd had 3D goggles where they could look at our region, look at our industrial parks, we'd have gotten even more interest.
You touched on this earlier, but I want to bring it up again. Do you see this technology as a way to push through those unfavorable notions about our region, about Eastern Kentucky, and to get people to take a look before they judge? What kind of message about Eastern Kentucky do you hope your use of this technology sends to the world at large?
Well, certainly, we know we're not going to have as big of an audience. We have a very focused audience for this technology and for these videos. But at the same time, if you look at the media and the videos that are out there, you really have the TV show Justified or some documentary starring Nick Offerman that came here a few years ago and went and talked to our friend Dan Mosley down in Harlan County. And a lot of times, you know, they pick the worst of the worst things to look at, even when I believe it was MSNBC or CNN came here not too long ago to do a story on Ab Harvest, and they were walking through Pikeville. They said the biggest employer was Walmart, and that's just not the case in Pikeville. You know, they have a massive healthcare system there that's extremely impressive and technologically advanced in Pikeville Medical Center. Mm-hmm. And so we want to make sure to get that type of positive information and highlight the good things that are here in Eastern Kentucky because it's not done really at all. I was going to say often enough, but it's just not done at all.
Well, it's going to be now, isn't it?
That's right.
All right. Chuck Sexton, President and CEO of One East Kentucky in Paintsville. Thank you so much, Chuck.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tom.
These days, we tend to talk about coal almost in the past tense, but that may be premature. What if you could turn coal into carbon fiber used to make things that call for lightweight and high strength? UK's Center for Applied Energy Research and the Oak Ridge National Laboratory are partnering on a $10 million project to transform coal into high-value carbon fibers and composites. And here to tell us about this work is Center Director Rodney Andrews. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Andrews.
Thank you.
Carbon fibers made from coal. This can be done.
Yes, it can. It's has been done in the past to make what we would call general purpose fiber, things that are used for insulation and brakes. And what we're now trying to do is make carbon fiber from coal that can be used for high performance applications, which is a much bigger market.
And what are some actual examples of how it would be used?
High performance fiber or medium grade, whichever way you want to use it, is currently used in things like sporting goods, airplanes, automobiles, anything where lightweight, high strength, and high stiffness are needed.
How far along are you in this research?
The project with Oak Ridge has been underway for a year. We are successfully making fiber by turning coal into a liquid, then processing that liquid to make intermediate that we call mesophase, and then turning that into fiber. And so at the Center for Applied Energy Research, we have been making small quantities of that, less than a kilogram. But the target is to be able to provide 100 pounds or more of that material to Oak Ridge to use in their carbon fiber technology facility that can spin a ton or more a year of fiber.
So how efficient would you say is the process of turning coal into carbon fiber now? Is it nearing a point where you think it would be ready for a manufacturing application?
The challenges that we're facing right now is economic. The processes need to be more thoroughly developed so that we know that it can be done economically. We know technically it works. Obviously, we also still want to make improvements there in the quality of the fiber. But as we go through the process and look at the efficiencies, we get about 90% of the carbon in the coal recovered as an intermediate. When we convert that, about 60% of that. And then when you make fiber, it's about 40% of that. So we have to improve those efficiencies all the way along the way, both in terms of energy and in terms of those conversions, in order to make this economical.
And I do understand that carbon fiber can crack if you smack it with a hammer, or machining and holes can also create weak areas that could increase the likelihood of breaking. Are those issues being taken into account?
Yes, those are things that are already worked on with current carbon fiber technology, where those fibers are derived from petroleum through polyacrylonitrile intermediates. There are technologies that allow you to work with that. Most fiber would not be used just as the fiber. It would be woven into a cloth, and that then also helps get around the local area breakage is spread over the cloth, and so it's much stronger and more durable than it would be as individual fibers.
Are you using a certain type of coal, and is that type present in the coal fields of Kentucky?
We are primarily focused on coals from Kentucky, mm-hmm. Central Appalachian and Western Kentucky coals. We do have partnerships that involve, you know, Western coals as well, but our primary focus and the materials that work the best for our process are actually from Kentucky.
Well, if it turns out that this is successful and the application is clear and new uses are found for coal, do you think it can be mined without causing so much environmental damage?
I think that's an area that there has been a lot of work, and there's a lot of work ongoing in looking at how do we reduce the impacts from mining. You know, newer mining technologies have a smaller footprint than has been used in the past. And, you know, we're talking here about where we need less coal because the products are so much more valuable.
Do you think this technology has the potential of playing a role in reviving the Eastern Kentucky economy?
The estimates for the use of coal for carbon fiber, if we can compete directly on price and performance, and some other products we can make similarly to this, are between 10 and 100 million tons per year of coal utilization. So it could be quite a significant amount of coal.
Well, this is going to be interesting to follow, and we'll check back with you later on, if we may, and see where things stand.
Of course.
Dr. Rodney Andrews, Director of UK's Center for Applied Energy Research. Thank you so much, Dr. Andrews.
Thank you.
You scream, I scream, we all scream for the return of the live music scene. And it is making a comeback. Undermain's Art Sheckett talks with David Helmers, founder of Lexington's Railbird Music Festival.
David Helmers, it's good to see you again.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's been about 2 years now since we spoke on this program with a lot of anticipation and excitement about the first iteration of Railbird 2019. There was lots of planning that happened for 2020, and we know what happened then.
Right. Like a lot of events, we got struck by the COVID and weren't able to have the event in 2020. But you're right, about 2 years ago, 2019, we were in anticipation of the inaugural Railbird event out at Keeneland. And here we are again on the cusp of the return of Railbird 2021.
Why don't you tell us about the plans for Railbird 2021? Give us some of the details.
The Railbird this year will take place August 28th and 29th out at Keeneland. And Keeneland has a tremendous campus out there, 1,000 acres or so outside of the track and the clubhouse that we're used to visiting during the race meet. And so we take over that area, including the Keene Barn and the Keene Entertainment Center and kind of the vast green space surrounding that, and erect a festival site with multiple stages. It's a 2-day festival, 3 stages, 30 plus musical acts. And it's just a really good time. If you attended Railbird 2019, you'll see a lot of familiar aspects, new artists performing this year. But some of the things that we had in 2019 will be back for the enjoyment of the patrons.
I think everybody was delighted with how Railbird 2019 went. Were you guys excited about how that went off?
We felt like we got an awful lot right, particularly for a first-year festival. We had about 15,000 people a day in attendance in 2019. We had 30-plus acts on 3 stages. People might remember some of our headliners, Hozier, Jack White and the Raconteurs, Brandi Carlile, and a local favorite, Tyler Childers. We're in that lineup along with folks like Old Crow Medicine Show and Mavis Staples and Gary Clark Jr. So we were really happy with the lineup. And beyond that, the overall layout and feel of the festival seemed to get A-plus ratings across the board. We provided a lot of amenities and shade, and then a lot of features that you wouldn't find at another festival, not at a typical music festival, but that really kind of helped show off Kentucky and some of the amazing aspects of our culture and our signature industries here in the bluegrass.
And people came from all over to attend that festival.
That's right, Art. I think the first year, about a third of the people attending Railbird were from outside the state of Kentucky. And we felt like that was a great response. We had people from 49 states, from 11 foreign countries, all traveling here to central Kentucky. Many had not been to Kentucky before or been to Keeneland before. Some had never tried bourbon before, so they certainly had an opportunity to do that at Railbird. And so far, it seems like we're even more of an attraction for out-of-state guests in 2021. The preliminary results from the ticket sales that have started for this year show even in a higher percentage, almost 46% of ticket purchases are coming from outside Kentucky. So we're looking forward to rolling out the red carpet or the blue carpet, whatever you want to call it, and welcoming them here to central Kentucky.
Surely one of the attractions is this great lineup that you guys announced. Why don't you tell us about the major headliners?
We are very excited. I think we have, it's safe to say, have kind of upped the ante for 2021. Dave Matthews Band and Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit are the Sunday headliners who will close out the festival and will kick things off Saturday, at the end of Saturday, with Leon Bridges and My Morning Jacket, a Kentucky favorite. So those are kind of at the top of the ticket. The other exciting part of Railbird is just how much depth there is and what you would call the middle of the lineup. From top to bottom, we feel like we've been very selective and put together just a great roster of artists for this year.
And will you have a curated local and regional stage like you did at Railbird 2019?
Yes, we will. So of the 3 stages there, we called one Elkhorn, we call one Limestone. And then the third local stage is the Burl stage presented by West Sixth. And that stage is a showcase for our local artists. It also includes some up-and-coming artists. I know Billy Strings played on the Burl stage in 2019. He's one of just a couple artists that are returning in 2021. We love having that local stage to give artists like Nicholas Jamerson and Magnolia Boulevard, Bendigo Fletcher, Grayson Jenkins. You know, these are homegrown artists right here from Lexington or Kentucky, and it gives them an opportunity to share the bill with acts like the Black Pumas and the Revivalists and some of the other folks who we'll see in 2021.
And the festival really also celebrated the food and culture and drink of central Kentucky. Tell us just a little bit about what your plans are for this year.
Sure, Art. From inception, we tried to differentiate Railbird from other music festivals by really embracing what's unique and local to Kentucky and central Kentucky. So there are many aspects of life in Kentucky that you'll see on display at Railbird, one of those being our signature bourbon industry. So I undertake the hard process of helping select single barrel bourbons from some of the great distilleries here in Kentucky, and we'll have 10 single barrel bourbons available for tasting and sampling and for purchase at the festival. We also showcase the great culinary artists of Central Kentucky. So we have 6 cooking demonstrations, 3 each day on Saturday and Sunday in the air-conditioned Keene Entertainment Center out at Keeneland. Chefs that folks from around here are very familiar with, like Weta Michael and Cole Aramis, Samantha Four, Kristen M. Smith, Jeremy Ashby, and we have a guest chef coming from Charleston, South Carolina, Travis Milton. And so they do open to the general admission ticket holders, cooking demonstrations, and showcase the food of Central Kentucky and food with Appalachian heritage. And so those are 2 of the aspects that are very near and dear to Kentucky, food and bourbon that we showcase. In addition to that, something that I don't know happens at any other festival, we have a spotlight on horse racing and the equine industry at the music festival. So in an area called the Lucky Day Plaza, you can bet on simulcast races from Saratoga and Del Mar. The betologist from Keeneland will help you pick an exacto or a trifecta and handicap some races. So in between musical acts, you can go into a large air-conditioned tent there, have a cold beverage, and maybe win a little money on the races.
We're not quite out of COVID, but we're getting there. Any anticipated modifications or precautions at this point that you're planning for the festival, or is it too soon to tell?
Well, I think the answer to that is whatever precautions or modifications are necessary will be in place. So we have been and will continue to be in regular communication with local health and public safety officials, and we'll abide by the relevant recommendations and guidelines that are current at the time of the event. In the meantime, you know, I'm vaccinated, and we're encouraging folks to get the vaccine. The more we do that, the more we're able to get back to normal and do these things with fewer restrictions.
If people want to find out more about Railbird, where do they go online to find out?
Well, www.railbirdfest.com is the website. There's lots of information on there. That is the portal to purchase tickets. So you can read about it, find out about the tickets that are available, purchase your tickets sooner rather than later. I would suggest the demand has been extraordinary, and we're excited about that. But that's the key place for information. There is a Facebook page, and our other social media are active, Twitter and Instagram. But the website is the key place for gathering information.
Good to talk to you again, David.
Thanks so much for having me. We couldn't be more excited, and we're really looking forward to August.
That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Mike Savage, our executive producer, Wendy Barnett, producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on air, online, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest a topic or an interview? You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.